This is Death Watch, the monthly podcast where we eulogize one of the greats who has recently passed by watching some of their work that we weren't previously familiar with. My name is Matt Brown.
And I am Matthew Price.
Thank you for adopting a duly respectful tone. I appreciate that. We're recording this.
I don't feel like you do appreciate it.
I do. No, I appreciate it. We're recording this episode on the 22nd of May, 2019. It'll be in your feed on Friday, May 31st. These episodes drop on the last Friday of every month because that seems appropriately funereal to me. Today, we're doing John Singleton, which is a huge, huge death in the film world. I mean, obviously, first of all, he just died way too young. He was 51. He died last month. Yeah. Also, just a singular influence in the world of cinema and also obviously black cinema in the 90s. So just a huge loss there. And honestly, you know, one of the reasons I like doing this show, a filmmaker, I feel like I'd seen half of his films. You know, there was a good opportunity to go back and watch some more of the work that I hadn't seen before. So that was, you know, the only nice thing I can say about his death. Everything else about it kind of just sucks. And also, obviously, when you do start reflecting on the work of someone who has died, you realize, boy, this guy had a lot more in him. There was there was more to be done here. This is just way, way too soon.
Yeah.
So we're gonna look at a couple of his films. What did you end up watching for the program?
Boys in the Hood.
So you did do Boys in the Hood, okay?
I did.
Outstanding.
And was lucky enough that in reaction to what happened, a Toronto Cinema programmed Boys in the Hood so I could see it with an audience.
Yeah.
Which was really great.
Cool.
Very special.
Yeah, I saw Baby Boy also with an audience, which was also fortunate. I did end up watching Boys in the Hood as well just to kind of catch up.
Oh, good.
But I watched that on Netflix, which is not the same. Anyway, we will get to the films in a minute. Before that, a little something we do called Roll Call.
Roll Call. Oh, wow. Oh, man. We're here. We're off the top.
It's always amazing.
I'm always surprised.
It's literally the first thing
I know. Every
intro.
Time you throw to me, I think, oh, I wasn't ready. Hello. Roll Call is, of course, the segment on our show where we just talk about the various other folks who have passed away since we last recorded a show. Given that we have a population on this earth approaching 7 billion, we're just never going to be able to do a show about everyone.
Unfortunately not.
Yeah, although that's the goal.
Yeah, guys.
We've set ourselves an ambitious goal of one of these half hours per month, and yet we somehow cover everyone on earth who has ever passed
away. That's right. Wouldn't that be something? And a little factoid about something, you know, that they did for all of them.
Oh, no, and watching a film somehow based
absolutely
on the life of every person.
Why not?
Sure.
Let's go for it.
So since the last time we met, we lost Mark Medoff, playwright, most famously known for writing Children of a Lesser God, and for insisting that a deaf actress play the role of the deaf lead character in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Would not sell his screenplay rights without that. So in addition to obviously giving Marlee Matlin a huge, huge career that she would never have otherwise had, but he also, that's one of the first times that I think representation actually was something that was thought of or consciously a part of the decision making, right?
Yeah, and I mean still just a huge, huge gap in Hollywood, the idea of
that
allowing
that could and would have very easily gone to a hearing actress.
Of course.
Who
would we still
play
just do
a
that
deaf.
Constantly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actress, this is notable and kind of amazing. Actress Faye McKenzie, who is one of three centenarians of note to pass away this month. Faye McKenzie was 101. She was an actress. She started in Silence and was still taking roles in 2018.
Nice.
Yeah. Henry Block. Any idea?
H&R Block?
Correct. The H in H&R
Block.
H&R Block.
All right. Tremendous.
Ken Kercheval, most famous for his role on Dallas as JR's nemesis. Actor Larry Flash Jenkins, who was a great character actor, was in Fletch, many other parts. Most notably, you would remember him as the kid who takes the car for a joyride in Ferris Bueller.
Oh.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. John Havlicek, who is an NBA star. Jack DeMello, composer. Fitzroy Gordon, black Canadian founder of G98.7 FM, which is Canada's only black and Caribbean owned and operated radio station.
Wow.
Should we do a honor roll call for Peter Mayhew?
You're goddamn right.
Let's talk about Peter Mayhew.
Yeah, I mean, not that, like, Peter Mayhew, especially for a man of his stature,
yeah,
lived a really long time. Like, it is hard for a body that is north of 7 feet tall.
Yeah, for your heart to pump
mid-70s.
That blood.
That's a lot
yeah.
of work.
Yeah.
God knows he had, you know, some health troubles towards the end, particularly in his legs. I understand his knees were in pretty rough shape. What a positive part of not just Star Wars from a performance standpoint,
but
the culture of Star Wars.
The community.
Yeah, like
everything.
Just a
yeah.
great, great, by all accounts, the sweetest man in the
yeah,
world.
Yeah, and kind of the opposite of David Prowse, right?
Yeah. Like, the surliest man in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Another giant that they hired that turned
yeah.
out to be a bit of a jerk.
Yeah.
Or not. I don't know. Maybe David Prowse is wonderful.
He certainly
felt
but
like,
certainly doesn't yeah. like Star Wars very much.
Yeah.
But yeah, Mayhew constantly at these conventions, meeting with fans, very much one of these, like, sort of kept the doors open for people.
Yeah.
Guys. And also just, and I think, you know, as it was pointed out many times, you know, it is remarkable to think about how easily we just think of Chewbacca as another character in the movies.
Yeah.
And not a guy in a suit.
Absolutely.
Right? It is, it's a remarkable piece of physical acting that you never even question it.
Yeah.
Right? He just is another character. It's
yeah.
astounding.
One of the formative experiences of my life, as many people I've probably told before, was seeing the documentary about the making of The Empire Strikes Back when I was 6 or 7 years old. I think actually when I saw
you
it,
you may
I
have mentioned this.
Yes, I've mentioned it. Yeah, 6 or 7 years old. I don't think I'd actually seen The Empire Strikes Back when I saw the documentary, but there is a very brief moment where they're talking to Mayhew. And he hasn't put on the fur yet, but he's got the makeup circles around his eyes because
right.
apparently they, you know, they did that so that you wouldn't see the pink of his skin. And I mean, that's one of those moments when you're a kid where you're like,
wait,
there's
what?
A guy in there?
What?
Like,
wait,
what are you talking? I mean, it's yeah. just, you know, that is a through the rabbit hole moment. And I, anyway, I will love Peter Mayhew for the rest of my life. And I appreciate the generosity that he showed with Chewbacca, again, to the fans, with the role, but also, you know, graciously acknowledging that he wasn't going to be able to do it forever and that they're,
and
you know,
training his replacement.
Training his replacement.
Yeah.
It felt like, not that, I mean, I don't feel like Steve Whitmire stole Kermit, but there's a real continuity in the Chewbacca performances that I quite like.
That,
you know,
that, yeah, that.
That
we,
didn't feel like it happened with
well,
Kermit.
Well, Henson wasn't thinking he was yeah. ready to give it up. So,
of course not.
Yeah. And that anniversary actually just passed.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
So, yeah. So, pour one out for Peter Mayhew, who
yeah.
I think, you know, by all accounts, an exemplary and wonderful life lived.
Yeah.
Okay. Back to our list. So, Rachel Held Evans, who was a Christian author, wrote books sort of faith, novels, but also quite significantly challenged traditional church roles for women and LGBTQ inclusion. She was just kind of coming into her own as an author. She was only 37, and she died of a brain swelling. And so it's kind of very
wow.
unfortunate. Yeah. But I thought notable because she was actually one of those people working within the community to change it.
Mm-hmm.
David Winters, who was a dancer and choreographer, and was one of the original Jets in West Side Story.
Wow.
Yeah. Red Kelly, 8-time Stanley Cup champion. And then just a couple weeks ago, Jean Vanier, who, you know, son of a governor general, humanitarian, a lifelong champion of the developmentally disabled, founded L'Arche, which is this incredible organization that integrates people with developmental disabilities into communities. And a strong candidate for the Nobel Peace Prize and many other things. So perhaps one of the great Canadians of history we lost. Boone Gould, who was the guitarist and co-founder of Level 42, a band that I treasure and continue to listen to, and well, that is a shame. Jim Fowler,
from Mutual of Omaha.
Oh.
The young one. This is how old we are.
Wow.
The young guy from Mutual of Old Omaha passed away.
Huh.
Not the old dude.
Weird.
The one who was on the ground. You know, while I stay in the helicopter, Jim will chase the hyena. Yeah. You know, that guy, he passed away. Yeah.
If you don't know what we're talking about, you are a lot younger than us.
Yeah, because, oh, God, Mutual of Omaha was this wilderness show where basically they would drop this poor guy, Jim Fowler, into, like, wrestle with alligators. Meanwhile, the guy who was the nominal host of the show would be, like, safely in the helicopter mm-hmm. going, ooh, that does look dangerous. Ooh, I hope Jim's okay. Yeah, I hope Jim's okay, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, Jim was okay and
till very recently.
Passed away, yes.
Yeah.
Screenwriter Alvin Sargent.
Yeah.
Wow. Let me just list this off. Gambit, Paper Moon, Ordinary People, Straight Time, Dominic and Eugene, which is like a hugely underrated film from the late 80s, a brilliant film. What About Bob? How do you go between all these genres? Then he wrote Spider-Man 2, 3, and Amazing Spider-Man?
That's also correct.
How do you... What is that?
Yeah.
That is...
Turns out that guy was really bad at writing Spider-Man movies.
Hey, man. Whoa.
I am on the record. I don't like Spider-Man 2. And I don't think anyone's going to stand
up. No, I don't
like
Spider-Man 2 either, but I don't think it's necessarily
stand up for Spider-Man
3
and
fault.
Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah. And I do think that, you know, that is a giant, just a titan.
Oh, huge. Yeah. Absolutely huge.
Michelle Roux, who was the president of Absolut Vodka, took over the brand in the early 80s when no one would drink that vodka and conceived that incredible media campaign for Absolut that actually made it the number one spirit in the world.
Mm.
That, you know, collaborations with artists, collaborations with celebrities, that whole iconic Absolut thing, it all came from him.
Wow.
And then pour another one out for Peggy Lipton.
Yeah.
Boy. That hit me really hard.
This hit a lot of people very hard. I saw it hit a lot of people. As a guy that never watched The Mod Squad and never watched Twin Peaks, it just sort of sailed right over me. But Twitter went nuts.
She was so great.
Was she?
Yeah, she really was. And she's, you know, she's this invisible glue that holds together Twin Peaks in a way.
Really?
I think so, yeah. Wow. Because she's the most lovable human person on Twin Peaks. And so, like, Twin Peaks is a show that I feel like when I watch it, every time we get to a scene with her, I breathe a little sigh of like, oh, we're back with her.
Hmm.
You know, and she just, yeah, she's just this wonderful person. You know, and also, let's be honest, it takes a special kind of person to marry Quincy Jones and stick with it. So, that guy's not easy. And then Doris Day, another one that hit people really hard. Boy, you never know that someone is so beloved until they go. And then, man, out of the woodwork. But also, like, yeah, Doris Day, that is the real deal, man. Mm-hmm. That's something. The biggest box office star for quite a while there.
Yeah.
Right? And not a person whose films, I think, necessarily lasted. Like, they are very much of their time, right?
Mm-hmm.
But boy, she couldn't have been more popular in the sort of 50s and 60s.
Right.
Yunita Blackwell, who was the first, get this, because this is really something, the first black and the first female mayor in Mississippi.
Wow.
Yeah. Also advisor to 6 presidents.
Hmm.
Yeah. One that I think, I'm guessing just based on the very short gap in our ages, hit me a lot harder than you, and that was Tim Conway.
Yeah.
You know, as someone who grew up watching the Carol Burnett Show and really just so much of, I guess, the template for what I find funny comes from what was funny on Carol Burnett, mm-hmm. more so than Saturday Night Live, you know, to some degree SCTV, but I feel like Carol Burnett, really the sketches on that show are what I conceive of as this is what humor looks like when it's done well.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim Conway, never not amazing on that show.
He's a very funny guy.
Oh, he's just great. WWE wrestler and Survivor Series 15 contestant Ashley Massaro. So I don't know if you were watching Survivor in season 15.
I definitely wasn't.
15.
Guys, I'm finally back on Survivor.
Oh, I'm so glad.
I just finished season 38. I skipped seasons 9 through 37.
And went right back.
I went right back in.
Yeah. Feels ironic that you're watching Survivor while we do Death Watch.
Doesn't it?
I'm doing it a little bit. Yep. Yeah. And then the second of our centenarians, I am Pei, architect.
Yeah.
Who, you know, I didn't talk to you about this before the show, but I thought, we could do a show just with films that feature the pyramid at the Louvre.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like, I mean, for real.
Last week,
right?
Last month, we were talking about doing films that just feature Notre Dame. That's a lot easier because there's a billion of them.
But yeah,
you're right.
Yeah.
In the last 20 years, boy, that pyramid shows it's at the beginning of Wonder Woman, for God's sake.
Yeah. It's in million. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. At least one of the Mission Impossibles.
Yep. It's right? In the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, so, you know, and like, as if that's his only incredibly iconic building. Oh, no, he has 30 of those,
yeah.
You know, but yeah, it's, but think about the gall of saying, oh, yeah, you know what the Louvre needs is this modernist pyramid right
yeah.
in the middle of it.
Well, like, we're from Toronto, so we'll put it this way. About 15 years ago, some jackass had the idea to grow a crystal out the side of our museum. It is lampooned to this day.
It's awful, but that's what I find so meritorious and incredible about the pyramid
yeah.
is that it works.
Yeah.
That it isn't, it doesn't look like the museum threw up.
Yeah.
Right? The way that ours does.
Yes.
Ours looks like the museum got sick and threw up.
Ours looks like something bad in a movie is happening.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Oh, the Matrix is glitching again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I am Pei, 102.
Good for him.
Yeah. Architects live a long time, man.
Well, it's a very calm lifestyle.
I feel like it is very zen. They learn to deal with things, right?
Lovely.
And then author and 103-year-old, not to be outdone, 103-year-old Herman Wouk, who
yeah.
wrote The Winds of War,
yep.
War and Remembrance. Boy, if you were alive in the 80s, you know, this was what was on TV.
Yeah.
Jeez. Some of these miniseries were incredible for their time in terms
yeah.
of their scale, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, he passed away having written, you know, hundreds of books.
And, mm-hmm.
Actress Michiko Kiyo, who was the star of Rashomon.
Oh.
The woman who yeah. is attacked.
Yeah.
Also was in Ugetsu, Floating Weeds, Street of Shame, Gate of Hell. So this is one Japanese actress who, over the course of her career, worked with Kurosawa, Mitsuguchi, Kon Ichikawa, and Ozu.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think...
It's pretty good.
That's pretty good,
yeah.
Right? And then just a couple days ago, Niki Lauda, who was a mm-hmm. Formula One racer in the 1970s, three-time champion, and was portrayed by Daniel Brühl in the movie Rush.
Yeah.
And that is...
Oh, no, my friend. That
oh,
is
no.
not roll call.
Oh, no. What did I forget?
Because we do have one more honor roll call.
Oh.
Your beer.
Oh! Well...
Send
I guess.
Me a photo
As
about
an
a week
audio
ago,
podcast, I don't know that we can
I
commemorate.
I feel like your beard is known enough to our audience
Perhaps.
From a decade of Mamo.
Folks, I, for quite a long time, have had quite a long beard.
It's not a small beard. It's a very large beard.
I had a big beard, yeah.
When you cut it off,
yeah.
did you bundle it up
No.
and bring it with
No.
you like a baby?
No.
No.
So here's the story.
Yep.
I did it for charity. We were raising
you
money.
You did it for charity.
I did. I an email went out in my
Son
company.
Of a...
an email went around in my company saying that a colleague, if we raised $200 for our in-house charity, our colleague would shave his head.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote back immediately and said, $200 for $400, I'll shave my beard.
Mm-hmm.
And that became a rallying cry. We raised well over $550.
Nice.
In a day.
That's great.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
And then we both got shaved in front of the whole company.
It
was fantastic.
You should have thrown the whole body on there as a bonus. Like if we get to 1,200.
I'll die?
No, the top. Like,
oh, I'll shave my whole body?
All my body hair. Go
I didn't want to make people
top
stop donating. So I...
Buddy, I would have gone in for 300
exactly.
just on that.
So I phoned my wife when I volunteered for this, after I had already said I would do it, and I phoned her and said,
So here's a funny story.
So here's what I've said I will do. Now, you know, I didn't expect a lot of resistance or whatever, but I said, yeah, it's going around at work. We're raising money. And I said, if we got to this $400, I'd shave my beard. She goes, all right. And then she hangs up. And then 10 minutes later, I get a text from her saying, hello, I would like to donate $400.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's just great.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was a roll call, and now we will talk about John Singleton. So he was born in 1968, Los Angeles. At 16, he starts hanging around USC Film School. Just hanging around.
Well, he's only 16.
He's volunteering as a gopher in, on the various students' film sets and so forth. One day, finally, the dean gets sick of it. He decides since he's acting like a student, they might as well make him a student.
Wow.
So he becomes a student.
Wow.
At USC Film School.
Guys, if you want to go to film school, that's how you do it.
Well, this is basically the Spielberg angle. That's what I was thinking about. Like when Spielberg got out of, he didn't go to film school, but when he gets out of college, he just starts hanging around the Universal lot. Like he puts on a jacket, walks through the gates of the Universal lot, just starts hanging around. That's like basically how he gets his career.
Wow.
And Singleton does the same thing, but with school. Hell yes, Singleton was a PA on Pee-wee's Playhouse. Hell yes, he was. He graduates USC in 1990, and then he directs his debut feature, Boys in the Hood, which you're going to discuss in 1991.
So there's the connection.
What, Pee-wee's Playhouse?
Well, there's Cowboy Curtis.
Sure.
On Pee-wee's Playhouse, and there's John Singleton going, you know, Larry, I have a script you should read.
Yeah. Yep.
And there's Larry going, yes, I'll read your script?
I guess
that's,
so.
What is that?
I guess so.
Oh, man. Yep. This is how the magic happens,
yep.
kids.
Absolutely. Yeah. And oh, so, we'll get to it.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah.
Anywho, so he gets a screenplay. He gets Oscar nominations for the screenplay and for director. He becomes the youngest in the latter category ever to do so up to this day. He's 24 years old.
Yep.
He's also the first African-American nominated for the award, and Boys in the Hood is preserved in the National Film Registry. And I, like I said, I also saw it this week, so we'll talk. Yep. He directed Remember the Time for Michael Jackson out of the or Dangerous? Dangerous.
Dangerous. And
yeah.
But that was Michael Jackson worked with a lot of film directors, but he didn't actually work with many directors of color. Like
I don't
work
think
with
so.
Spike Lee? I don't think he did,
so.
Right?
No.
So yeah, that's kind of notable too.
Yeah, absolutely. Continues throughout the 90s with various social dramas like Poetic Justice, Rosewood, Higher Learning. In 2000, he makes the fourth, now of five, Shaft film. After that,
but the first kind of reboot of Shaft.
It's not. That's the thing. Shaft never
rebooted.
Oh,
it acknowledges.
Yeah,
yes.
Shaft 4 is.
But it is like, let's do a new Shaft.
Yeah, just like Shaft 5 is also apparently just yet another sequel.
Yep.
Just keep spinning out new Shafts and putting the old Shafts in them. By the way.
Out new Shafts.
Yeah, man.
That doesn't sound right.
That's right. That Shaft movie's pretty fucking good.
Fourth one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
If you haven't seen that, that's a pretty good movie.
That is some peak Samuel L. Jackson right there.
Yeah,
and
Jeffrey Wright is terrific. Christian Bale, who is just about to start breaking into adult roles, is a racist motherfucker, and he's...
Terrific.
So good. Like,
it has a great... I remember it having a really kick-ass car chase.
Yeah. He does some great stuff there. Speaking of that, so after Shaft, he does the movie that I'm going to be discussing, Baby Boy, largely as a reaction to Shaft because he felt very kind of boxed in on the creative control of the Shaft movie.
Okay.
So he makes Baby Boy. Then he goes and he makes the best Fast and the Furious movie, Too Fast, Too Furious. Ask me how, readers.
Are you going to talk about it?
We can talk about it later.
Let's talk about
we'll
it.
We'll talk
too
about
fast.
It towards. We can talk about it towards.
I definitely want to talk about Too Fast.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We'll talk about it a little bit later on. But then, like most underappreciated minority or female directors in the zeros, he gets moved into television. So he's directing episodes of like Empire and American Crime Story and so forth.
Yeah.
And he did Four Brothers in there. Yeah. But you know, one of the things that was interesting when I was reading about Baby Boy was that. Baby Boy is kind of the end of him working with all black casts, primarily black stories. He starts doing mixed race casts, mixed race stories. So his career really kind of has just two halves. And after Baby Boy, he's not dealing exclusively with African American stories anymore. This is a quote that's going to come up probably in anything that you read about him. So I'll just kind of read it from the top to the bottom. This is from a discussion he did at Loyola Marymount University in 2014. They ain't letting the black people tell the stories. They want black people to be what they want them to be, white people want them to be. And nobody is man enough to go and say that. They want black people to be who they want them to be as opposed to who they are. Black films now, the so-called black films now, they're great. They're great films, but they're just product. They're not moving the bar forward creatively. That's a quote that you got a lot of play in the last month.
Mm-hmm.
When you try to make it homogenized, when you try to appeal to everybody, then you don't have anything that's special. He had a stroke on April 17th of this year, and in a sequence of events that kind of reminded me heartbreakingly of the death of Carrie Fisher, we all sort of just held our breath for a few days, but then unfortunately on the 28th he was taken off life support and he died at the age of 51.
Yeah. And like so many black men, died of heart and stroke.
Yeah.
At a way higher clip than anybody else. Doubly a shame, I think.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I think we have to start with Boys in the Hood.
He did.
Which is insane.
It is. Well, I'll tell you, it was so interesting going to see this movie because I spent, my entire life. I remember when Boys in the Hood came out. I remember making a choice not to see it based mm-hmm. on what I thought the movie was then.
Yep.
Based on this perception that I had that it was something that it was not.
Me too.
Yeah, it was not what I thought it was going to be at all.
Yeah.
The biggest thing that gets mentioned as soon as people talk about Boys in the Hood is New Jack Cinema.
Hmm.
And this has nothing to do with that at all. Like, I saw New Jack Swing and a lot of these films it's nothing to do with those films. Those are flashy crime.
Yeah.
Caper action films.
That's right.
This is not an action.
And it's not a crime drama either.
It's not. It's a melodrama.
Yeah.
It's a massive melodrama on the scale of the 1930s, the 1920s.
Yeah.
It's like silent melodrama.
Yeah.
Like for most of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're not, by the way, melodrama is not a pejorative term in this context. We should
Brilliantly done. No.
Yeah.
I think, I will say that I think it gets more confident and better as it moves along.
That is certainly
and
true.
And I don't know that the first half of this movie really feels like someone's student film. A good student film, but it really feels like a student film. Something is lacking in that prologue, that extended prologue with them as kids, where it just doesn't totally click. But it grows with confidence and style with every scene.
Well, I'll tell you what's lacking in the prologue, which is, by the way, the first half hour of the movie, so more than a quarter of it.
Yeah.
Which also I had no idea.
Yeah.
The kids are terrible. That's what
they are. They're terrible.
They're very bad.
They're terrible. But also the directing's flat. And there's a lot of stuff going against him in that first half hour.
Yeah.
Especially because he's using it to try to get you bought in that you've known these characters all their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And, when the movie sort of starts over with them as adults.
Yeah.
There's not only are the performances a lot better, there's relatively no relationship between the young versions of those people and the current versions. Like, I don't know that first half hour is even really necessary to make the film work.
They don't echo against each other thematically in any way.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a moment, there's literally a moment where they're on some train tracks and one of them's like, you want to go see a dead body? And the camera cranes way up. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, it's a Spielberg movie. It's Stand By Me.
Well, it is 100% Stand By Me.
One of the things I've kind of been aware of recently is when we talk about people that are not, when I talk about filmmakers that are not white men, there's an overwhelming, not just, this is a bias to sort of analogize them to white male filmmakers because that's 98% of the case examples that are sort of drilled into us as we study film, right?
Yeah.
So I don't like saying that Singleton is very Spielbergian, but I mean, based on the way he broke into USC and just sort of the way his career is, I think, why weren't we talking about this guy as a Spielberg-adjacent young filmmaker? Like, he has very clear, first of all, his command of the craft is on that level.
He
knows what to do with the camera. But he's also, I guess I grew up with a much harsher read on what kinds of stories Singleton was trying to tell. You know, it's like I said, this is social 100%. Drama. This is social drama.
And when you think about how this was mischaracterized and hystericalized in the press, when this movie came out, the only thing people talked about was there are gangs and riots going on in Los Angeles around this movie. And I'm watching this movie thinking, people were fighting about this?
Yeah.
Were they watching it? Because I feel like there was not a lot there that would have been in any way even interesting to someone whose daily life was in a gang watching real people die. Never mind contentious and willing to fight or somehow amping up some sort of... But, it's a melodrama.
Yeah.
This is... if you take away the specifics, mm-hmm. this is for ladies. This movie, like, and I mean that in the nicest way possible. Like, this really is like an emotional movie about feelings.
Well, it's definitely an emotional movie about feelings, but I don't know that I can possibly go along with that big.
No, and I don't think it should be that way. But I just mean, you know, in 1990, with you know, what were gang members? I mean,
well, that's, I mean, that is
it's what incredible
is,
to me.
That is what is interesting to me about this film and also the one that I watched, which is Baby Boy. And I didn't get the chance to watch Poetic Justice, but I wish that I had, because he considers them kind of a loose trilogy in terms of theme. Yeah. But he is very openly critical of black males.
Yeah, and the kind of
masculinity
that goes. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. And from reading about Baby Boy and then reading about this, I mean, it's something that got repeatedly in a lot of different articles was that was highly frowned upon in the black community, was the idea that, you know, you don't openly criticize
the characters cry.
Yeah.
And the hero of Boys in the Hood really is the Larry Fishburne character, who really spends most of the movie saying, this stuff about being tough is bullshit, man. It's nonsense.
You
should definitely get away from it.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, the Fishburne character, first of all, Fishburne's fucking terrific. I mean, surprise, surprise. He's a great actor.
There's a shocker.
Yeah, I know. He's terrific in this. I mean, the movie almost overplays his hand, like, on how good his character is.
Yeah.
Right? He is almost saintly and perfect in his every detailed move. But I also have to imagine that was a very unusual voice in the black community at that time. Especially, like, there's that scene where he goes in front of the billboard and he's just like, this is why gentrification is bad.
Yeah.
And he just lays it all out, and then his people flock up and are listening to him. Yeah. And it's like,
including the old guy from Sanford and Son.
Yeah.
I love that, like, he pulled that card and was like, let's get this guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think it was a terrific movie. And I mentioned this on Letterboxd. I'll say it again. The moment that just absolutely killed me, just because he's such a humanist, right? Singleton is such a humanist. He can't not see these characters in multifaceted ways.
Yeah.
Like, even Fishburne, who is a little bit one-dimensionally perfect, is humanized. But there's this moment. So, spoilers, if you haven't seen Boys in the Hood, one of the characters gets shot towards the end. He gets killed.
Yeah.
And then the others go out hunting for the guys that killed him. And until then, we've only ever seen these other characters, these bad guys, quote, in conflict situations. So we haven't really spent any time with them. But before our guys catch up to them, there's like a 30-second scene of these three guys just sitting around a table.
Yeah,
they're just sitting around a fast food table having hamburgers, talking about girls, talking about bullshit, which is exactly what we've watched the other three characters do for the entire movie.
Yeah.
And I just lost my shit. Like, that idea that both the exact
they're
same story
people.
Happened
to the two
opposite sides of this conflict.
Yeah.
Oh, it was just gut-wrenching.
And the idea of Increase the Peace and saying, like, you know, you think you have this legitimate reason to kill someone. You don't.
Yeah.
You don't. It's really, it's the antithesis of the films it got lumped in with.
Yeah, it really is.
In a crazy way.
Absolutely.
And that ending is great. And that's what I mean about, I mean, that is really an example of a movie where, because the way that it resolves is so good, it almost erases any of the problems that you might have had with it along the way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at you, the full Monty.
You
get a great, great ending, a great final couple of scenes, and you almost like, the shyness on the whole film.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I've said this before. I really like that kind of movie. Like, if your last 15 minutes can really sell me on the solidity of the whole project, I'm with you. I'm entirely there.
But you brought up a point, which is, you know, why weren't we talking about this guy like Spielberg? Well, what's interesting is I don't think you would have found a director hotter at the time than Singleton, in terms of, you know, he's broken through. He's done. I mean, I think especially in light of the fact that Do the Right Thing was only a couple of years earlier, and there had clearly been this bias against Spike Lee for being, I don't know, too angry or too talented or making all white directors look amateur. I don't know what it is, something. But he, you know, he breaks through that in this really significant way to the Hollywood establishment. He could easily have just cashed it in with a bunch of commercial films. He could easily have said, I just want to make my job now is to make movies that make lots of money so that other filmmakers have it easier. He could have done that.
Yep.
He didn't do that.
Right.
He went right back into films he cared about that are incredibly personal. So the reason he's not Spielberg is because he didn't want to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you seen Baby Boy?
I have not.
Okay. So I've covered off some of Baby Boy already. Baby Boy is theoretically the third part of the Boys in the Hood trilogy. And, you know, surprise, surprise, I freaking loved it.
Mm-hmm. Tyrese is
there. Yeah, absolutely. And in the same interview as the quote that I read earlier, Singleton identified Baby Boy as the film of his that he would want people to go back and watch after he had died. I did not know that when I saw the film.
Wow.
I found that out after. Felt
yeah, yeah.
a little weird that that's what had happened.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
yeah, it's really very strong. It's obviously, you know, it does the same thing where it is very critical of black malehood and the forces within the black community that are causing harm to the black community. Am I right in saying in Boys in the Hood there are no white characters? There isn't, like, no one turns up. There isn't, like, I guess there's the one white cop, but the black cop is the one that's always being harsh on.
That's even worse. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, I mean, there's certainly no significant characters.
Yeah. So same thing here. Like, it takes place entirely within a black world and is focused on a black man who is extremely flawed, like, in a way that feels heroic for putting that character out front in a movie, because he really, really does not have his shit together. And it's not even like he starts to put his shit together at the end of the first act and then just gets better and better. He relapses a lot in the course of this. Like, the things that he learns in the movie are hard won. And I thought that was really good. Tyrese is, you know, it's I don't know. I haven't seen him in a lot of things outside the Fast and the Furious movies. Seems like it's probably going to go down as his best performance. Like, he's really
yeah, that's
to
not
put
an actor that, you know, needs to stretch. He's,
no, yeah, I don't
you know,
think so.
He's in it for a good time, but that's okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Instead of Lawrence Fishburne in this one, you got Ving Rhames as the father figure. This case, it's an ex-con who is shacking up with Jody's mother, Tyrese Gibson's mother.
Yeah.
So it's a much less glorified guy.
Sure.
He's significant.
Not a role. More difficult to be a role model for the younger character.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a lot more friction in that relationship. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, Ving Rhames is obviously completely terrific. That guy is always amazing. There's this one scene. This is just hilarious, where Tyrese, who's already pissed off that this guy's coming over, he gets up and Ving Rhames is in the kitchen cooking eggs for mom, naked. And he just plays the whole scene. I'm like, that's... Wow, Ving, well done. And then, but then, in sort of to pair off scenes like that, there's a later scene where he actually escalates.
Sorry, I just had an image of Ving Rhames naked, and then the phrase "pair off." You know, guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, go on.
Yeah, but then there's a later moment where he actually does escalate into physical violence against Jody, and it's, you know, obviously terrifying and heartbreaking that that's where that goes. But there is a weird, the fact that he can actually flex at that level within the same performance, within the same character, really, really, really powerful.
Yeah.
Taraji P. Henson's first role in this movie. So again, finding great talent and putting them on screen.
Because let's talk about did he discover Cuba Gooding Jr.?
Yeah.
I mean, and really, for all intents and purposes,
Ice Cube.
Ice Cube. I mean, in terms of his acting career, which now you could call Ice Cube a pretty big movie star.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously has a great eye for talent. And this movie is, you know, just it is one of those things where I saw it, I thought I kind of had a handle on it, but I just kept thinking about it after and more and more and more. It's just, you know, it's the whole package.
Movies are machines that make empathy, folks.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And that is certainly... I thought about Roger Ebert a lot watching both of these films. They seemed like they were... I haven't actually
gone
back to
alley.
Read his Boys in the Hood review yet, but yeah, it really seemed like the kind of thing he was interested in.
I do want to say that the other thing that both these films, I think just your description of this one too, brings to mind is the really excellent show just finishing its second season, The Chi, which is Lena Waithe's show set in Chicago, a multi-character black character drama, which also spends so much of its time taking apart a lot of these myths around masculinity and what it means to be a black man, a black woman, and how that translates out into this sort of modern urban existence. And it's really like... I think if you've got an affinity, I think if you say, like, what's his influence, a show like The Chi is his is clearly a straight line, right?
All right. Is that on the Netflix?
In Canada, it's on Crave.
Crave.
In the United States,
any man's guess.
Maybe Hulu? I'm not sure.
Sounds like Hulu.
But it is a great show. It's a 10-episode season, couple seasons in. And, yeah, it's really, it's beautifully constructed. Really, really well done.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's just tie this thing off with Too Fast, Too Furious.
Oh, yeah. Here we go. Get into it.
As old listeners of our previous podcast, Mammo, might recall, I mean, you didn't get into Fast and the Furious late. I did. I came in at number 4.
So did I.
Oh, that is where you came in. I thought you'd seen number 1 before that.
Did
we both start at number
4? I don't think I had. I just kind of knew what they were.
We're great at this.
Yeah.
So, you know.
They never appealed to me before that.
Well, and they don't appeal to me now. But taking pot shots at that franchise is one of my favorite things. Look, man, we've all had a good time watching the Fast and the Furious movies, and I've seen some that I liked and some that I didn't like.
And let me be clear. If you can get through the Hobbs and Shaw trailer and not have a gigantic grin on your face, you ain't alive.
That's right. But here's the thing. I did watch, like, whenever one of them, I think it was number 6, was going to come out, I was like, final.
Let's see them all.
I'm like, let's go through all these. The thing that becomes clear, and I am not trying to throw any shade at Justin Lin or even Rob Cohen, but the thing that becomes clear when you watch them all real close together, John Singleton is a real director, and those movies are different if you put a real director in that seat.
Yeah.
Because Too Fast, I mean, I know everyone says it's the worst one. I don't agree. I think Too Fast is the only one that actually gets what kind of a movie this whole thing should be like, or could have been like back then before it turned into the Avengers. But it is a 70s car exploitation movie all the way through. It's perfectly done from that standpoint. It is a crime drama. It's ridiculously stupid and ridiculously fun all at the same time.
It's also unbelievably homoerotic.
It's incredibly homoerotic.
Unbelievable tension.
For sure.
Boy, you thought Top Gun.
No.
Let me tell you.
No.
This movie, they're so in love with each other.
They're so in love with
each
other. It's beautiful, and they're always wrestling. They're always sweaty.
Always wrestling.
And Singleton's like throwing.
Like,
there is a scene where they go into a garage. This is when they meet Tej for the first time.
Yeah.
They go into a garage, and then the back of the garage, for some reason I've never been able to work out, is just a jet ski marina. And there are girls in bikinis riding around on jet skis and swimming and playing volleyball. And I'm like, he's literally putting this here to, like, try to distract you from the fact that his two lead
These
characters
These guys are
going to
kiss. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Anyway, like, I stand up for Too Fast all the time. I used to just do it for the title, to be honest, because it's the best sequel title in cinematic history. But I still think that, like, all of the Fast movies, they're fine. That one's actually a movie. That one, that one you should go see on the big screen if it comes to your town. It is that kind of a film. That's all I wanted to say about that. I know I'm very in the minority on this, but that's the one I will stand up. And Tokyo Drift is a stupid cartoon that I enjoy, but Too Fast is whew, that's my one.
All right.
Yeah, man.
Good.
Yeah.
Nicely said.
Anything else you want to conclude with, or shall we sign off for another
nope.
month?
This is the timer has begun on the new beard.
All right.
I'll be back.
I'm
enjoying the idea of actually having a solid start date.
Yep.
So, we'll keep you all posted.
Absolutely. With each...
I know you're all can't wait to hear how it goes.
Each death, there is the promise of a flower.
My favorite thing is that someone described having the long beard as a lot of work. I'm like, it is the opposite of a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's not doing anything.
That's right. The first, for anyone who's never had a beard for any reason, the first month after you shave it off, that's the bad time.
Yeah.
That's the worst. You don't feel like you look good. Your face can oftentimes hurt or just be irritated. It's very psychologically, it's
you
a lot of
reaching
pressure.
For it,
yeah.
And it's not
you're
there.
Trying, yeah. Yeah, you're trying to think and
it's
gesticulate.
It's like a phantom limb.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So we wish you the best of luck with that.
I
don't believe we've picked our June subject yet.
Nope,
so
have not.
So either someone tragically will pass in the next few weeks and we'll pick that person, or we will go into the back catalog and find someone that is already no longer with us. But either way, you can follow us on Twitter at DeathWatchPod for that announcement. Usually happens in the first or second week of the month. And then, as I said, the episode drops at the end of the month. If you are listening to this on May 31st, please enjoy Death Watch and then enjoy Deadwood, because not all things that die stay dead. And I appreciate that. Thanks, HBO, for giving one of the best shows in the history of television one last go. Thanks, everyone. We'll talk to you next month.
Sure.
So, are you ready?
Got it.
All right, guys, listen.
Yo, team.
Hey, everybody.
Hey.
No. Also, Flemmy. What an afternoon. All right.
What? Just that we're doing Death Watch, and the first thing that popped in my mind was, what a time to be alive.
Mm-hmm. No, I think we're, you know. One of the reasons I like this show, it makes me feel good to be alive.
Yeah, same.
You know,
same.
I don't feel like a sense of foreboding or anything.
No.
I'm just like, yeah.
I was describing this show
better to him than me.
I was describing this show to a colleague that actually knows us from Mamo, a new colleague at the office, but he's friends with Corey Pierce.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knows us from Mamo. And he was like, what's this other show? And I'm describing it to him. And, you know, we eulogize and sort of it's a tribute show to somebody who's recently passed away. And we each watch like we haven't seen. And he goes, yeah, what's it called? Death Watch.
A colleague of mine keeps calling it Death Wish because I guess he just can't get it into his head. And I'm like, nope.
That's a very different show.
The opposite.
Ascribes a lot of a lot of power to us that we don't have.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Every month we decide who's going to pass away and then we do a show about
that. I know. No, the best was after we did that episode of Mamo and someone was like, man, it was good to hear you guys doing a podcast again. I was like, fuck you,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
Fuck you. All right, let's get this party started.
This episode has been brought to you by the Modern Superior Podcast Network.